Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Tania Plibersek makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think the last time the Minister was here, she spoke about social housing in the previous government, and now she's changed her portfolio. So I'll introduce Tania Plibersek very briefly. The Minister has been the member for Sydney since 1998. During the time of the Howard government, she had a number of important shadow ministerial responsibilities. In the first Labor government, the Rudd government, Tania Plibersek was Minister for Housing and Minister for the Status of Women. And since the the last election under the Gillard government, Tania Plibersek is Minister for Human Services and Minister for Social Inclusion. And it's in this latter capacity that she's going to address the Sydney Institute tonight on the topic of Australia's social inclusion heritage, past, present, future. The Minister, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared. It's a great pleasure to be here with so many friends this evening. I want to start by acknowledging that we're meeting on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Former Labor Minister Tom Urin speaks very movingly about Sir Edward Weary Dunlop, the surgeon who commanded the first Australians sent to work on the Thai section of the Thai-Burma Railway in 1943. Tom says that when he and Weary Dunlop were prisoners of the Japanese, Dunlop led by example, he insisted that the strong take care of the weak and that inadequate rations be pooled with food reserved for the sick so that they could recover. Beatings were frequent and severe. There were no medical supplies. Tropical disease was rampant and the Japanese required a level of productivity that would have been difficult for fully fit and well-equipped men to achieve. Yet Weary Dunlop looked after his men and he demanded that they look after each other. He refused any special advantage that was due to his rank. Dunlop defied his captors, he gave hope to the sick and he eased the anguish of the dying. He became, in the words of one of his men, a lighthouse of sanity in a universe of madness and suffering. This style of leadership was the reason why Australian survival rates were higher than those of other nationalities, according to Tom. And the example set in the camp became the heart of Tom's political philosophy. If you ask the average Australian what they see as uniquely Australian values, many will point to egalitarianism, mateship, a fair go for all. We see ourselves as tough and self-reliant, but quick to offer a helping hand to those who need it. These values are often seen as best expressed on the battlefield where lives depend on cooperation and mutual trust. But I believe these values colour our lives in times of peace also. Australia has been, for generations, seen as a social laboratory. Our welfare system, our democracy, our industrial relations all led the world in many respects. Payments to widows and deserted wives, the child endowment, public education and state aid, universal healthcare, universal superannuation, all of these were great achievements and all of them reflect our values as a nation. When reflecting on the Australian approach to welfare in 1977, Professor Ronald Henderson, the academic who gave his name to the Henderson Poverty Line, observed that welfare policy is conceived not simply as a matter of institutions and services for the poor and vulnerable, important though these are. It is seen above all as a matter of strengthening the social fabric in which we all live. The answer to who cares must be everyone. It's not only our approach to welfare that echoes these values. When Justice Henry Higgins delivered the landmark Harvester judgment in 1907, he ruled that workers were entitled to a basic wage that, and I quote, must be enough to support the wage earner in reasonable and frugal comfort. The Harvester decision espoused positive liberty, the idea that freedom meant not only being free from the interference of others, but being given the power and resources to act to fulfil one's own potential. The values that underpinned the Harvester, were also borne out in the fight for the 8-hour day. When the Commonwealth Arbitration Court finally approved the 40-hour, 5-day working week to begin in 1948 nationally, it was the culmination of a century of struggle by working people. It allowed time for leisure and, with that, time for learning and for community work. Our democracy itself has also been an important part of this social laboratory. In 1902, Australia became one of the first nations to introduce universal adult suffrage for non-Indigenous people. In 1918, preferential voting was introduced, and in 1924, compulsory voting was introduced with the passage of a private members' bill. Every Australian had a right to vote, and with it, every Australian had a responsibility to participate in our democracy. The Gillard government's commitment to social inclusion is a natural progression in the march of social development in an Australia where each of us is equal in value, has the right to the basics of life and the responsibility to contribute what we can to our family and to our community. Australia's achievements in social welfare, the industrial environment and citizenship show that while the language of social inclusion might be new, the philosophy behind it is not. It's part of the continuum of social development in Australia, representing all that Australians have aspired to, not only for themselves, but for their fellow citizens. The objective of social inclusion is that everyone in our community should have the opportunity to both reach their full potential and participate fully in the social and economic life of our nation. Social inclusion aims to reduce entrenched forms of disadvantage. Kids growing up in jobless families, homelessness, people locked out of paid work because of disability or mental illness. By getting services from across the government and non-government sector to work together efficiently. Take jobless families. While Australia has relatively high workforce participation rates and low levels of unemployment by international standards, the number of jobless families is still too high. The rate of family joblessness is the fourth highest in the OECD, behind the UK, New Zealand and Turkey. We've been successful over the years in improving this situation, particularly in recent times. By mid-2008, before the impact of the global recession on the Australian economy, the rate of family joblessness had returned to levels not seen since the early 1980s. Between 1995 and 96 and June 2010, the proportion of jobless families fell by nearly a quarter. The number of dependent children living in households where no parent had a job declined from around 756,000 to around 580,000. We must hold on to these gains, but we must do better still. Employment is the surest way out of poverty for every member of the family. Kids who grow up in jobless families are more likely to become unemployed as adults. Children learn from their parents and carers. They see them managing the responsibilities of having a job as well as being a parent. From a very early stage, kids fantasise about what they'll be when they grow up. And from a very early age, children start to make calculations about what is possible and what's not. If they've never known anyone who's gone to university or never known anyone who goes to work every day, they quickly come to believe that their futures are limited. Addressing the incidents and needs of jobless families with children is one of the six key social inclusion priority areas of the government. The others are delivering effective support to children at greatest risk of long-term disadvantage, focusing on particular locations, neighbourhoods and communities to ensure that programs and services are getting to the right places, addressing the incidence of homelessness, employment for people living with a disability or mental illness, and finally, closing the gap for Indigenous Australians. The fact that these challenges have been selected is no surprise. They are challenges that have faced us as a nation for many years. Yet in each of these areas, new, concerted, focused, evidence-based approaches are being used to make headway against these so-called wicked problems. Without doing a full evaluation of all the work underway, it's worth making some general observations. Labor's approach has been practical, setting measurable goals and attacking problems using available evidence, measuring success, doing more of what works and less of what doesn't. our approach in this respect has not been ideological. I know Jared will love it that I'm quoting Deng Xiaoping tonight at the Guangzhou conference in 1961, saying, "I don't care if it's a white cat or a black cat, it's a good cat as long as it catches mice." An example of this is our Better Futures Local Solutions program that brings together the first three priority groups of jobless families, children at greatest risk of long-term disadvantage, and the needs of specific communities facing entrenched disadvantage. After extensive trials of place-based assistance in the human services portfolio, these types of programs formed a key component of our $3 billion workforce participation package announced in the government's budget this year. Place-based programs take advantage of local expertise and conditions rather than relying on one-size-fits-all models driven by bureaucrats in Canberra. The place-based approach uses the wisdom and strengths of local communities and allows us to target effort to fixing intergenerational challenges such as low educational attainment, welfare dependency and unemployment, which are concentrated in some communities. These new programs have been controversial because we're requiring more from disadvantaged job seekers. Teenage parents, jobless families and others will have higher expectations placed upon them if they live in these locations, as well as tighter compliance requirements. But they'll also get more assistance and greater support. In 5 of the 10 Better Futures Local Solutions sites, the government will use income management for very vulnerable people. Parents who are at risk of neglecting their children, people who are at risk of failing to pay the rent and becoming homeless. I make no apologies for this approach. Standing by and allowing people to blow their money instead of feeding their kids or paying the rent is not doing anyone any favours. Critics say this is not a long-term solution and that we must empower people, and I agree that the best solution in the long term is for these Australians to get a job, to learn to manage their money and to overcome the complex issues that have led to their chaotic life circumstances. But in the short term, the kids need feeding and the rent needs paying, or the consequences are catastrophic. Our commitment to addressing homelessness is as historic as 1985, when the Hawke government established the Supported Accommodation Assistance Program. In total, Labor has invested more than $7.5 billion to build around 40 specialist homeless shelters, 20,000 new public housing dwellings, and to reform our services so that we actually move people out of homelessness instead of them just cycling through short-term accommodation. In the area of mental health, the 2011 budget included the nation's largest ever mental health reform package, $2.2 billion to deliver additional services and focus on prevention, early intervention and a better integrated system. The National Disability Strategy, agreed by the Council of Australian Governments in February 2011, is a long-term roadmap for improving the lives of Australians with disability, their families and carers. The strategy will help us create better services, programs and community infrastructure so that people with a disability have access to quality education, to healthcare, the support they need to get a job, to access buildings, transport and the media. And our next big reform in this area will be a national disability insurance scheme. Labor's also delivering unprecedented investment in closing the gap for Indigenous Australians. Jenny Macklin spoke to the Sydney Institute about those efforts, I think, last month. While Labor's reform agenda builds on the Australian tradition of giving a helping hand and a fair go, our programs also reflect the value of self-reliance. We're happy to help as long as we believe that people are doing what they can to get back on their feet, if it's possible. This is what I mean about enduring Australian values guiding what we do and how we do it as a nation. In the past, values arguments have often been simplistic left versus right propositions. Some were prepared to wrap themselves in khaki, rightly proud of the self-sacrifice and bravery of Australians in the past, but ignoring the horror of war felt by most returned servicemen. Ignoring also the fact that being proud of our history means acknowledging our failings too. Some on the left, on the other hand, came to see patriotism and pride in our achievements as jingoistic and a bit naff. The hostility returned Vietnam veterans faced in the 1970s was a particular low point. But Southern Cross tattoos and car stickers became cool with one section of Australian society. Another part of our community came to see this expression of patriotism as exclusive or boorish or aggressive. Yet it doesn't need to be this way. John Howard adopted the language of mateship, but not the values. The values of the strong looking after the weak, of self-reliance coupled with a sense of responsibility for one another. Some feminists have argued that we shouldn't use this language of mateship as it excludes women, but I don't agree. Women serve on our front lines now, and most of you would have heard today that the government has decided to open every position in the military to make them available to women, simply depending on people's physical capacity to do the jobs or not. But women have served on our front line, they serve on our front line now, about 10% of our service personnel who are overseas at the moment are women. And throughout our military history, they've been in harm's way as nurses and as prisoners of war. Yet women have done much more. They've worked in the Women's Land Army, they've worked in factories, they've worked at home to support the war effort. In the 1930s, during the Great Depression, women kept families together and put bread on the table any way they could while their husbands went on the Wallaby Trail. Women fought for and won the right to vote, to equal pay, full equality before the law and protection from violence. Australian women have as much right to claim a heritage of toughness, self-reliance, compassion and self-sacrifice as Australian men. Mateship and patriotism are much more than simply painting our faces green and gold at sporting events, tattooing the Australian flag on our shoulder or wearing a Wallabies tracksuit. Patriotism means genuine love for our country, and that love is indivisible from our love for our fellow citizens. Love of this country is about more than lifestyle. It's not all beaches and barbecues. It's indivisible from our best characteristics: resilience, mateship, egalitarianism and tolerance. Patriotism should be expressed not simply in overt and superficial ways, but in the deeper and more meaningful ways. How we treat each other, how we build our nation, how we ensure that all Australians have the opportunity to reach their full potential. Our patriotism should be inclusive, not exclusive. And to help do this, we should more openly recognise our diversity as a key strength. Of multiculturalism, few have said it better than former Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser in 1981 when he said, Australian multiculturalism is a unique achievement. Australia may have stumbled into the multicultural epoch. We were a nation comparatively small in size and insular in outlook, but within a period of time that is short in historical perspective, Australia has been enlarged in capacities, talents and outlook by millions of men and women from every corner of the globe. While multiculturalism is part of our national character, it's not a replacement for it. Multiculturalism policies, as Tim Soutphommasane says, were, and I quote, aimed at integrating immigrants into a national community defined by shared liberal political values. The right to express one's cultural identity was balanced by the obligation to endorse parliamentary democracy, the rule of law, freedom of speech, English as the national language, and equality of the sexes. People often disparage the idea of studying or considering our civic values. It doesn't seem to move people in the same way as our ideas about our military history, our sporting achievements, or Dorothea McKellar's notion of a sunburnt country. It's true that we don't have the revolutionary pedigree of other countries like France or the United States that give civic life a fascination that it has not historically held here. Our nation wasn't born of war or clash of civilization or clash of values or revolution against imperialism, but we do have a citizenship framework to be proud of. I love going to citizenship ceremonies. I love the bravery and the optimism of people who leave everything behind to come here for love or for work or for safety or to build a better life for their children. I once heard a butcher in Lakemba saying that taking Australian citizenship was like having a second child. When you have your first child, you think it's impossible to love another child as much as this first one, and yet when that second child is born, your heart expands and your love is doubled. So, he said, was taking citizenship the opportunity to love a new country as much as you ever loved your birthplace. I tear up when I see new citizens take the oath or the pledge, and I tear up when I have that opportunity during citizenship ceremonies to repeat the pledge myself. From this time forward, I pledge my loyalty to Australia and its people, whose democratic beliefs I share, whose rights and liberties I respect, whose laws I will uphold and obey. It's quite simple, but very beautiful, and I would be amazed if many Australians had ever taken the opportunity to repeat those simple words. To see and hear new Australians become citizens is a wonderful thing, for those people are making a very public commitment to Australia and accepting the responsibilities as well as the privileges of Australian citizenship. I think every Australian should know the pledge. I'm busy memorising it myself. Every Australian child should learn it by heart and say it regularly at school. American kids pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States and all that it represents, and so should Australian children know and understand our nation's citizenship pledge. Indeed, all Australians should understand their rights and responsibilities as citizens of this great nation. Of course, this means obeying Australian law, but I think it goes beyond sterile legality. You're under no obligation to help someone on the street. The Good Samaritan would have offended no law nor failed in any legal obligation had he simply walked on. Yet our values, the laws within that govern our behaviour and the way we treat each other, are every bit as important as black letter law. I believe there's a Chinese proverb: laws govern the lesser man, right governs the greater. A clear and constantly restated commitment to this most fundamental value, egalitarianism, a fair go, social inclusion, mateship, whatever name it goes by, would pay tribute to our past and continue to build a strong foundation for our future. Our rich nation is in many ways the epitome of a socially inclusive society. Yet I believe we can do still better. Not because I suffer from cultural cringe or a black armband view of history, but because we have achieved so much and we have so much potential. Graham Freudenberg has argued that the notion of a fair go has been central to all the big debates in Australian politics. That notion of the fair go continues to enliven current debate and is an important test for our future decisions. I'm truly optimistic that, driven by our love for our country and our love for our fellow citizen, we can continue to work towards a society in which each of us can reach our full potential, and the future of our children is not determined by the postcode in which they're born. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister, and thanks to Mellisons for the use of this great facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got plenty of time, so we'll end sometime before seven. Can I just start off? The Prime Minister, when she was then Deputy Prime Minister, addressed the Institute in this room about 2 years ago on social inclusion. And as you know, your government's been in office 4 years. I guess the government that's most promoted the concept of social inclusion has probably been Mark Rann's government in South Australia. And he appointed David Keppo as an outside advisor on social inclusion. But after, say, 6-7 years of social inclusion policies under the South Australian Labor government, do you think that people are more socially included in Adelaide than they are, say, in Brisbane?
It's a really good question, and I guess there are a few different ways of addressing it. You can ask a philosophical question about whether people feel more connected to their society, or you can look at the practical outcomes of their social inclusion agenda. And if you take, for example, homelessness, I think they've dropped the rate of rough sleeping in central Adelaide by about 50%. I think that's a stunningly good achievement when homelessness has been such a long and enduring problem in Australia, and in fact we saw across most of the country, even as our economy was booming, numbers of homeless people increasing. So I would say, looking at the evidence on the ground, yes, it's working. I don't think we can say we've solved any of these problems yet, but where we see problems that have been intractable for decades and in some cases centuries, and we make significant progress, I think that's something to be celebrated. As for whether people feel more socially included, I guess you'd have to ask a South Australian.
So what about a Sydney sider? Question there, yes.
I just wanted to thank you, Minister, for your work this evening. I found it not only information-based, but actually inspirational. So thank you very much. And not so much a question, but that was the first comment. And the other I wanted to say, too loud. The other I wanted to say is that as a result of hearing your address this evening, I'm going to leave this room tonight walking tall, proud to be Australian. So thank you.
Thank you. That's very kind.
You'll be included in the future.
And you're always welcome at my place.
That's right.
Minister, I would like to thank you also for your comments this evening, Margaret Bell. I'm very appreciative of the fact that our government has identified social inclusion as a very important aspect of development during this parliamentary period. However, I'd like to ask what you think about the behaviour within the parliament and within, particularly within the media. I work with very disadvantaged families in Western Sydney a great deal of the time, and I'm increasingly disappointed to hear that young people very genuinely believe, in many environments, not only that environment, that to be grown up is to be aggressive. Yeah. And one of the reasons that this aggression seems to be very prevalent is the behaviour of parliamentarians in particular, who really, as models, are providing some real distraction from participatory democracy. Have you got a comment about that whole area of division through the media and division through parliamentary behaviour?
Thank you for your question, Margaret. In fact, I think that could be the subject of a whole evening's discussion, and I find it difficult to do justice to it in a short answer. I certainly think that our democratic institutions, people get frustrated when they watch Question Time on television. They see, 5 seconds of Question Time on the news at night, and they think, oh, all they ever do is fight. My experience as a parliamentarian is that over the many years I've been a parliamentarian now, there's a great deal of cooperation, there's a great deal of goodwill, there's a great deal of courtesy, and that what you see is always the highest level of conflict of the day, because that's what makes news, that's what is news. We're used to thinking of conflict as news. I would say, though, I don't want to be particularly political about this tonight, the Parliament at the moment is more hostile and combative than I have ever experienced in my life, and I think many of our debates are more negative than I have ever seen. There's a lot of just saying no, even to what seem like perfectly reasonable propositions. I think that that's not just hard for people in the community. I think it does inevitably damage people's faith in our democratic institutions when they can't see parties come to agreement on things that they seem to share common ground on in the first instance. I'm trying to be very diplomatic here. Okay, well, I think the fact that Tony Abbott says no all the time is really damaging our democracy. I think it's very bad to just say no, even to ideas that start off as your own ideas.
Minister, Rep Speed, I hear. Was so inspired by your speech about mateship and egalitarianism and all these values that, I hold dear as an Australian. And you mentioned that, a fair go seems to inform sort of most of the debate within Australia and at the centre of it. One area where it seems to be very absent is the debate around boat people, asylum seekers. How do you feel about that and the fact that not only the media and in Parliament, but, public, there's such a visceral reaction suddenly to the point where, if you go to certain parts of Sydney, there's, the F-off where full speakers on the back of bumpers, bumpers on cars, and that sort of thing. And, is that notion of a fair go only if you're an Australian citizen? And how do we sort of lift the debate? Because at the moment, the debate seems to be about whether...
No, I understand the question, and it's a very topical question. I think the debate at the moment is incredibly simplistic. It's very black and white. We've got on the one hand the sort of, reaction that you're talking about, people who say that there's no right of asylum seekers to apply for asylum and so on. On the other hand, I also think that however compassionate we want to be, however welcoming, multicultural, however much we want to help the world more and help displaced people more, we do need to have a system that doesn't put incentives into it for people to take the riskiest way to come to Australia. I don't think anyone's having this debate in a sensible or a sophisticated way at the moment. That is part of the 5-second grab on the news at night and the just say no sort of politics that's going on. I think that we do need to find a way of discouraging people from taking a journey where 4%, 4 out of every 100 people actually die making the journey. And I don't think, you know, being cruel and temporary protection visas and all the rest of it, I don't think that's the way to do it. I don't think that that's fair or effective. But we can't just say, you know, if you get here, that's fine, you can stay either. That's not a system that people can have faith in, and it's not safe for the people who are making that trip.
Minister, thank you for your wonderful speech. I wanted to hear your views on whether you felt the federal government could have a stronger role in facilitating volunteering.
Yep.
It's an area I feel very strongly about, because I think not only can it assist in helping in so many areas and is, but in a reverse way, it does help with social inclusion by involving what is an enormous and partly quite significantly untapped resource of people who are looking for things to do, particularly in Australia. I think it's quite unique in Australia with many people who retire early. And there is this wonderful resource there which, if the government could see its way to build on this ethic of volunteering and strengthen the ethic, I think that could have a major impact on social inclusion.
I think you're absolutely dead right about volunteering. Volunteering is fantastic for the people who receive the services of the volunteers. It's great for the people who get their meals on wheels or whose kids play soccer on the weekend. It's also really important for the volunteer themselves. A lot of all of the research shows that people who volunteer live healthier, longer lives because they're participating in their community. There are ways that the government seeks to support volunteering. I just was with Parliamentary Secretary Julie Collins yesterday announcing $16 million worth of volunteering grants to small organisations to help them with their petrol and so on. But I think that we need to do more to lift the profile of volunteering and to encourage a culture of volunteering. And I'll be making some announcements a little later in this year about ways that we can do that. I'd love to give you the scoop tonight, but I'm not quite able to just yet.
Just to go back to the time when Labor used to just say no.
You told me not to be diplomatic, Jared, and now I'm going to get in trouble for it.
On industrial relations. I mean, you made the point about 2008, and you made the point that since then unemployment, family unemployment has been, is no longer decreasing, and you coincided that with the global financial crisis, which is correct. But it also coincides with Labor's re-regulation of the labour market and the reintroduction of penalties for unfair dismissal. Now, just let's take someone in, you mentioned Lakemba, or let's take Elizabeth in South Australia. And if I run a small panel shop and someone lobs up to me, who's 17-year-old, a young man who may have left school at 15, who's never worked, who's not particularly well-educated and he wants a job, I might give him a job if I feel that if he doesn't perform, I can get rid of him easily. But if I feel if he doesn't perform, and I'm running a small business, and it's difficult to get rid of him, why would I employ him? So, in other words, is there some confluence between the increasing level of unemployment and the re-regulation of the labour market, particularly with reference to unfair dismissals?
Okay, so the thing I need to correct, we're actually doing much better now on jobless families. The improvement has been significant. I'm So I don't think you can say that our industrial relations environment is causing an increase in the number of jobless families. That's a very long way from correct. Do employers make decisions about whether they can get rid of people? Well, if someone's not performing in their job, you can get rid of them. You have to go through a procedure to get rid of them. Unfair dismissal is about dismissing people unfairly without a reason and without a procedure. So I'm not going to apologise for having rules around unfair dismissals. I think that it is important, however, to have entry-level jobs. And for people who, like if you're talking about a 17-year-old who, you know, can barely get themselves out of bed and, you know, turns up to work some days and doesn't some days, yeah, I understand why an employer wouldn't want to take a chance on that person. So we've got a number of employment programs, educational programs, traineeships, subsidies to employers and other ways of making it more attractive for that employer to take that person on. I think again, you've had these discussions about industrial relations and I don't want to spend all night doing it, but there is plenty of evidence that shows that the greatest growth in productivity was nothing to do with individual contracts. We didn't see an improvement in labour force productivity because of individual contracts. You see it because of investment in your workforce and investment in your plant and equipment. Yes, you want flexibility at workplace level, but open slather doesn't make better workplaces.
Seth.
Thank you, Minister, for coming here. It was very good to listen to you. But I would like to comment on a bit refugees and also saying no in Parliament. With refugees, basically, we've got two external options. One is Nauru, another one is Malaysia. Clearly, Nauru is a better option at this point of view of human rights and us controlling it. Why your government is saying no to that option? Why you can't deal with this government?
Can I just make a brief point? I mean, the Minister's come here to talk about social inclusion, and we had Chris Bowen here as Immigration Minister, so I mean you can respond, but it's not simply a night on immigration, and it's really a night on the more general social policy.
All right, I'll respond very briefly to the specifics of the question. I don't think Nauru is a better option. We're talking about a projected cost of up to $1 billion to reopen that facility, and all of the advice from the Immigration Department is that Nauru would not work as a deterrent to people smugglers because they know that over 90% of people who were resettled from Nauru were resettled in Australia or New Zealand last time round. So the expert advice from the Department of Immigration is that Nauru would not work as to prevent people paying people smugglers or making a dangerous journey. As Jared says, this is an issue that I'm sure we could debate all night, but I'll just leave it there.
We don't have all night, yeah. So down the back, yep.
Minister, egalitarianism is very important in Australia, and a lot of studies have shown that, but it's not so important in some other countries. Dick Smith mentioned a week or two ago that he thought that some more people should be giving money to help some of the people who are a bit lower in the social scale or whatever, and it sort of just disappeared into thin air. Mm. You make a comment on how ungenerous we are at the top levels in Australia, compared to the Americans.
Yeah, I think we have we've got a different culture of philanthropy here. There's two things I'd say. The first thing I think is it's important for people to pay their taxes, and I think one of the most damaging things I ever remember hearing is Kerry Packer saying, "If you paid your tax, you're a mug." I think paying your taxes is part of your civic responsibility to one another and to the country. So the way our tax system operates is a really important first step in making sure that big companies, wealthy individuals pay their fair share. The United States doesn't have I think our tax system could do with improvement in part, but I think the US tax system is, quite nutty in parts. And some of the tax breaks that people get there mean that, they're not sensible tax breaks. So the fact that they're putting more in as philanthropists is a great thing, but we shouldn't in Australia be thinking of philanthropy as a replacement from each of us systematically paying our fair share. That said, I've spoken to Australians who've worked in very senior roles in the US and who are philanthropists here in Australia who put a lot of their money into very good causes. And they tell me that when they sit around at a dinner table in, you know, Los Angeles or New York or, you know, wherever they're from or wherever they've been working, there's the thing that people discuss most are the causes they're supporting and their direct involvement and support of those causes. So it's not just about giving money, it's about being involved and supportive and bringing some of your corporate knowledge and corporate contacts to support those organisations as well. And that part of it in particular, I really think we should be emulating more. That active engagement of wealthy and successful people with organisations, with particular causes, giving money, but also giving advice and support and promoting. We've got some, mind you, terrific examples of philanthropists in Australia, people who do things quietly on a social level. We've got huge examples of very generous arts benefactors as well, obviously the Caldwell Collection at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, but also the fantastic new Museum of Modern Art in Tasmania. Now, there are great examples, the extension here of the Museum of Contemporary Art. So I don't want to say that we, you know, we don't do any of it here, but I think that we could increase our some people could certainly increase the money that they give, but also other types of support would be terrific.
In fairness to the late Kerry Packer, I think he said if you paid more tax than you had to, you're a mug.
I think we all know what he meant though, Jerry. Oh,
well, he's not here, so I don't know. We can't interview him.
Following on from what you said, Tony, in regard to the question previously, there's a group now called the Sydney Alliance. Now, the question I've got for you is really, how do you see that as working in terms of a social inclusion concept, and what area can the federal government sort of help in that way, or people who've got money who can actually help in that group of Sydney Alliance, and where do you think they're going to be going?
I think the Sydney Alliance is a really interesting and a terrific new concept, and people who haven't heard of it, you've got the various levels of government working with non-government organisations, trade unions and, you know, basically interested Sydneysiders to focus on our geographic location here and improving not just the physical place that we live, but really giving people the opportunity to donate, see their money spent in the community that they care about, on the people that they see every day are being overlooked and neglected. So I think it's a really good opportunity. The Sydney Alliance will lobby for, you know, greater resources and better coordination between levels of government, non-government organisations and so on. So I think these location-specific organisations are haven't done a lot of it in Australia in the past. I think other countries have been much more likely to have local trusts where people have been able to donate locally to see their money spent on local homelessness or local services for children and so on. I think it's a great thing to have people coming across all different walks of life and all different backgrounds to really they're very highly motivated to improve their local community because they see the problems firsthand, but they also see the difference that they can make firsthand.
So, Brenny, you go down there and then around the other end of the... we're getting towards the end. There's one there and there's one over here.
Minister, it's a while since I took my citizenship ceremony in, so it was good to hear the words again. Refreshing to hear you talk about values. My impression, however, is that people are somewhat reluctant to define a set of values and put them forward. And I'm not sure whether that's the population at large or governments as well. If you believe in that sort of area and you're able to make a significant change and advancement in people understanding and adhering to a set of values, what would you do to make a significant step change?
How would I how would I encourage people to act on their values more, or which values would I promote? Gee, that's an easy question. I don't know that there is as much confusion about our values as people suggest. I think that while we don't talk explicitly all that much about what are Australian values, I think when you ask people what do you see as Australian values, they are those values that I talked about, a fair go, egalitarianism, tolerance, openness, multiculturalism. You know, well, that's not a value, but that's an expression of a value. Equality between men and women, support for parliamentary democracy, obeying the law, and so on. I think I could probably list them pretty clearly, and I don't think we have confusion in our community about values. I think we have people who live by their values and people who don't, or people who, for whatever reason, have had the kind of values chip turned off in their brains. They're not empathetic. They don't think, how would I like to be treated in this situation? They don't, you know, their life is about their own kind of fulfilment, and it's not consideration of the world beyond them and what suits them. I think there are people like that. I don't think that's because we don't, as a community, understand our values. I think it's because those people choose not to live by those values. How would I make people live by their values more? I don't really know the answer to that. I think values in the first instance are taught in families. But I think some kids grow up never being told to say please or thank you, let alone, you know, think about other people, think about how you'd like to be treated, what can you do for your community, instead of, you know, just what do you expect people to do for you. And where individuals are let down by the, like where kids are let down by the people closest to them, I think obviously school and early childhood education, preschool, childcare, those places are the only opportunity we have to help those kids learn values if they're not learning them at home. So that's why I have always argued that investment in early childhood education and in schooling are some of the most important investments that we can make. They really are our greatest opportunity to transform the lives of kids who are missing out at home. So, you know, if there was one place that I would have to say, and this is not an abrogation of parental responsibility, this is not saying that families aren't the first place that children should learn to consider others. It's simply saying that not all parents are teaching that at home, and so if we've got a backup, that backup has to be early childhood education in the school system.
There's a question there, then we cross to Terry Sheehan. Yep.
Hi, Tanya. I'm involved with aged care. I understand when you talk about social inclusion to disadvantaged people, disadvantaged families and children. I just wonder, where does the social inclusion involve aged care? I see in a lot of areas how aged care is not being socially included as, you know, I'd like to see it.
I think it's a very important point, particularly as our community is ageing and we're actually trying to understand what impact that's going to have on the lives of our ageing population, but also our community as a whole. Mark Butler is doing a consultation at the moment. He's been travelling around the country and he was in my own electorate recently for a consultation, talking to people in the aged care sector and to older Australians themselves about what the future of aged care looks like. And that's partly a funding discussion. How are we all going to pay for the fact that as people age and our desire is to make sure that they've got the very best accommodation, very best supports at home, very best medical support as well. How are we going to do that? It's also a question about the type of aged care system we want? Is it a system where the place you get into is the only place that's available on the list and you take it or you don't? Doesn't matter whether you're ready for that level of care now. Doesn't matter whether you can afford it or not. It doesn't, you know, the system at the moment is haphazard. It's got shortages in it, and the difference in the quality of accommodation and the quality of care you get depending on where you end up is unacceptable as well, in my view, that it can be very haphazard indeed. So the Productivity Commission's done a very important piece of work about the future of the aged care industry. Mark is doing that consultation at the moment, and we'll be having more to say about that as government in the future. But I can tell you little things that are happening along the way now that are about social inclusion in aged care. In my own electorate, I've got a lot of gay and lesbian people, and they're ageing, and they're worried that they're going to be separated from their partners when they go into nursing homes. Their partner's going to feel uncomfortable visiting or not be able to visit. And we've done a training through the Department of Health and Ageing with some of the gay and lesbian health organisations with the aged care sector about how they can better support and include gay and lesbian older people in facilities. There's a lot of work like that, I think, going on as well.
Second last question, Terry Sheehan.
I hate to sound like a grumpy old man. I'm very encouraged by everything you've had to say tonight and by the reaction of the people in the audience. The most demoralising thing that's happened in my life, I think, in the last 10 years was to think a couple of months ago that our citizens were much more concerned about condemned table animals than they were about people being persecuted in other countries very close to us. And I wonder whether you must have had a reaction a bit like me. You didn't know whether we'd ever turn the community around in the wake of that reaction to that ABC program.
Terry, it's, you know, I have often wondered about this. Like, I've got to say up front, I don't think animals should be treated cruelly. They should be stunned before they're killed, no question. What amazes me still, though, is that this is the single largest set of correspondence that I get is about the treatment of animals. And I'm not disparaging that. Like you, I'm sure, I don't disparage that issue at all. It surprises me that it motivates people in a way that concern for human beings sometimes doesn't. Or maybe it's just that they're a better organised lobby group. But I think it has to be possible for us to apply the same level of passion and compassion to how we treat one another as we do, as you say, the meat we eat.
Just a final question. As you know, you've only been in 4 years and you've got presumably 2 years to go, so there's not a lot of history there. But what would you say was your main achievement in 4 years in social inclusion, and what would you hope to achieve in, say, the next 2 years, which would be over a period of 6 years? What would you have achieved? What would you hope to achieve?
Well, I think our... For my money, I'd say that our greatest achievement in social inclusion is what we've done in homelessness, and it really is a revolution. I think that we'll see really significant improvements in the next count of homeless people coming out of this census. I always put these caveats on. We haven't fixed homelessness, and we can't reduce our effort, but we will see fewer people who ever become homeless, and we will see fewer people who stay homeless. We will see more people who are permanently housed coming out of the changes to programs and the significant investment that we've made. And both as Minister for Housing in that role and now as Social Inclusion Minister, I go to new facilities that are being opened all the time and I meet people. I met this guy in Adelaide. You were asking about Adelaide before. I met this guy in a Common Ground facility in Adelaide who was showing me his little bedsit apartment, and he took me onto the balcony and he showed me down on the street the disused service station across the road, you know, cyclone wire around it. And he said, "You see that place there? I slept there every night for 3 years, and now I have this beautiful little new bedsit apartment." There is, if I died tomorrow, nothing would give me as much satisfaction as knowing that there are people who have a roof tonight because of things that this government has done. Nothing can take that away, and it's one of the things that I am proudest of. Not just my own role in that, obviously, but having two prime ministers who have supported that agenda, having a treasurer and a finance minister. All the ministers that normally say no have said yes to this program, these programs, and I think that's amazing. But there are so many examples of that. There's a, you know, what we're doing with communities for children, boosting up the support services for families, particularly in disadvantaged locations. We look at what's happening in those locations, and young mums who've had terrible lives themselves are reporting increased confidence, reduction in harsh parenting practices, increased school and preschool attendance for kids, increased society and workforce engagement from the mothers. And these are revolutionary things that are happening in our communities, very quietly, but revolutionary things. They will actually stop disadvantage in this generation for some people. Not for everyone, but for some people. And for many people. And that, I'm very proud of that.
Many thanks. So it's always great to have Tony Plepasek of the Sydney Institute. Her paper will be published in due course in the Sydney Papers online. It'll be up on our podcast tomorrow. And Channel 648 from Foxtel and Austar is here tonight as well. I'll be very brief. The Minister concluded by talking about the present and the future, with particular reference to her role in housing, which it's an area which the Minister's addressed the Institute before. But in her paper, I mean, we've just had over half an hour questions and discussion. It's been a pretty lively night. But in her paper, the Minister also spoke about the heritage in this area, and it's always, I think, it gives greater substance to any address, particularly in an organisation like the Sydney Institute, if you look at the past as well as the present and a bit into the future. And so we had a very wide discussion tonight virtually of social inclusion policies in Australia going back over a century to the time of Federation. So we're very grateful the Minister could find time tonight to come along and give an important address, which will last, and that's what we're all about here. So well done tonight. No doubt you'll be back again in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.